Indeed we do. So, hypothetically speaking, if we agree to stash you away, what do we get right now on this table? Obviously, we have Mercado. Was he your immediate contact? Was there someone above him? How many names can you give us? How much money? Who got it? DeLuca nods and looks around the room. He hates ratting, and he has spent his career brutally punishing informants. However, there comes a time when a man has to worry about himself. He says, I will tell you everything I know, but I want a deal in writing. Now, on this table, as you say. I don't trust you. You don't trust me.
Fair enough. We have a standard short-form agreement that we've used for years. It's been approved by various defense lawyers. We can fill in a few blanks and see what happens.
DeLuca is taken to another room and placed before a large desktop computer. He types his own statement.
About 6 weeks ago, I was approached by a man who identified himself as Mickey Mercado. Said he was from Miami. He actually knocked on the door of my apartment, which was odd because very few people know me or know where I live. As it turned out, he knew a lot about me. We went to a cafe around the corner and had our first meeting. He knew I was a deacon and had spent time at Garvin. He knew all about my criminal record. I was a bit rattled by this, and so I started asking him a bunch of questions. He said he was a security consultant. I asked what the hell that means, and he said he worked for various clients, primarily in the Caribbean and so on, and he was pretty vague. I asked him how I could be sure he wasn't some kind of cop or agent or some such prick who was trying to suck me into a trap. I asked if he was wearing a wire. He laughed and assured me he was not. Anyway, we swapped phone numbers, and he invited me to visit his office, see his operation. He swore he was legit. A few days later, I drove to downtown Miami. Went up about 35 floors and met him in his office. Nice view of the water. Has a secretary and some staff. No name on the door, though. We had a cup of coffee. Talked for an hour. He asked if I still had contacts inside Garvin. I said yes. He asked how difficult it would be to take out another prisoner in Garvin. I asked if he was talking about a contract. He said yes. Or something like that. Said there was an inmate who needed to be extinguished because of some vague bad deal with a client of Mercado's. He did not give me a name, and I did not say yes to the contract. I left and drove home. In the meantime, I dug through the internet and found very little about Mercado. But I was almost convinced he was not a cop. Our third meeting took place in a bar in Boca. That's where we cut the deal. He asked how much it would cost. I said $50,000, which was a big ripoff since you can get a guy rubbed out in prison for much less. But he didn't seem to mind. He told me the target was Quincy Miller, a lifer. I didn't ask what Miller had done, and Mercado didn't offer. It was just a business deal as far as I was concerned. I called John Drummock, the leader of the Deeks at Garvin, and he arranged it all. He would use Robert Earl Lane, probably the most dangerous man there, black or white. They would get $5,000 each up front, another $5,000 when the job was finished. I planned to pocket the rest and screw them. You can't take cash to prison, so I had to arrange payment in cash to Drummock's son and Lane's brother. At our fourth meeting, Mercado gave me $25,000 in cash. I doubted I would ever see the other half, regardless of what happened to Quincy Miller. But I didn't care. $25,000 is gravy for a prison murder. I then met with Adam Stone, our mule, and planned the killing. He delivered messages to Drummock and Lane. The attack was well done, but they didn't finish the job. Stone said another guard got in the way or something. Mercado was furious at the bad result and refused to pay the rest of the money. I kept $15,000 cash. Mercado never mentioned his client's name. He was my sole contact. Frankly, I didn't inquire since I figured it's best to know as little as possible in a deal like that. If I had asked, I'm sure Mercado would have ducked the question. A friend of mine in Miami, a former trafficker, says Mercado is sort of a semi-legit operator who is often hired by traffickers to fix problems. I have met with him twice since the attack on Miller, but both meetings were not productive. He asked if I thought it might be possible to get to Miller in the hospital. I went there and looked around, but didn't like what I saw. Mercado wants me to monitor Miller's recovery and find a way to finish the job. Skip DeLuca.
With the conspiracy to kill Quincy still active, the FBI must make a decision. It prefers to watch Mercado and hope he leads to bigger fish, perhaps even using DeLuca as bait. However, as long as Mercado is on the loose and planning to finish off Quincy, the danger is real. The safest route is to arrest Mercado and apply pressure, though no one within the Bureau expects him to talk or cooperate. DeLuca is kept in jail, in solitary, under surveillance, and far from any form of communication. He's still a career criminal who cannot be trusted. No one would be surprised if he contacted Mercado if given the chance. And he would certainly make sure John Drummock and Robert Earl Lane knew that Adam Stone is a rat. Agnes Knowlton makes the decision to arrest Mercado and to get Adam Stone away from Garvin. Plans are immediately made to move him and his family to another town, one near a federal prison where a better job is waiting. Plans are also in the works to send DeLuca to a camp where surgeons will alter his looks and give him a new name. Once again, patience pays dividends. Using a Honduran passport and the name Alberto Gomez, Mercado books a flight from Miami to San Juan, and from there he rides an Air Caribbean commuter to the island of Martinique, French West Indies. The locals scramble to pick up his trail in Fort-de-France, the capital, and he is watched as he takes a cab to the Oriole Bay Resort, a lush and secluded getaway on the side of a mountain. 2 hours later, a government jet lands at the same airport and FBI agents hustle to waiting cars. The resort, though, is booked. It has only 25 quite expensive rooms, and they're all taken. The agents check into the nearest hotel, 3 miles away. Mercado moves slowly around the resort. He has lunch alone by the pool and drinks in the corner of a tiki bar with a view of the foot traffic. The other guests are high-end Europeans with their mix of languages, and none raise suspicions. Late in the afternoon, he walks along a narrow path 50 yards up the mountain to a sprawling bungalow where a porter serves him a drink on the terrace. The sparkling blue Caribbean stretches for miles below him. He lights a Cuban cigar and enjoys the view. The man of the house is Ramon Vasquez, and he eventually wanders onto the terrace. The woman of the house is Diana, his longtime mate, though Mercado has never met nor seen her. Diana waits and watches from a bedroom window. Ramon pulls up a chair. They do not shake hands. What happened? Mercado shrugs as if there are no problems. Not sure. The job wasn't finished on the inside. They speak in soft, rapid Spanish. Obviously. Is there a plan to complete the deal? Is that what you want? Very much so. Our boys are not happy at all. And they want this problem to go away. We thought you could be trusted for something this simple. You said it would be easy. You were wrong. And we want the deal closed.
Okay.
I'll work on a plan. But it most certainly will not be easy. Not this time.
The porter brings Ramon a glass of ice water. He waves off a cigar. They chat for half an hour before Mercado is excused. He eases back to the resort, suns by the pool, entertains a young lady during the evening, and has dinner alone in the elegant dining room. The following day, Mercado uses a Bolivian passport and returns to San Juan. Chapter 37. There are only two incorporated municipalities in Ruiz County, Seabrook, population 11,000, and the much smaller village of Dillon, population 2,300. Dillon is to the north and farther inland, rather remote and seemingly forgotten by time. There are few decent jobs in Dillon and not much in the way of commerce. Most of the young people leave out of necessity and a desire to survive. Prospering is rarely thought of. Those left behind, young and old, muddle along living off whatever meager wages they can find and checks from the government. While the county is 80% white, Dillon is half and half. Last year, its small high school graduated 61 seniors, 30 of whom were black. Kenny Taft finished there in 1981, as had his two older siblings. The family lived a few miles out from Dillon, in an old farmhouse Kenny's father bought at a foreclosure before he was born. Vicky has put together a spotty history of the Tafts, and they have seen more than their share of suffering. From old obituaries, we know that Kenny's father died at 58, cause unknown. Next in line was Kenny, who was murdered at the age of 27. A year later, his older brother was killed in an auto accident. 2 years later, his older sister, Ramona, died at the age of 36, cause unknown. Miss Vita Taft, having outlived her husband and all three children, was committed to a state mental hospital in 1996, but the court records are not clear about what happened after that. Commitment proceedings are confidential in Florida, as in most states. At some point, she was released because she died peacefully at home, according to the obit in the Seabrook Weekly. No will was ever probated for her or her husband, so it's safe to assume they never signed one. The old farmhouse and the 5 acres around it are now owned by a dozen grandchildren, most of whom have fled the area. Last year, Ruiz County assessed the property at $33,000, and it's not clear who paid the $290 in taxes to prevent a foreclosure. Frankie finds the house at the end of a gravel road, a dead end. It has obviously been abandoned for some time. Weeds are growing through the sagging planks of the front porch. Some shutters have fallen to the ground. Others hang by rusty nails. A thick padlock secures the front door, the same around back. No windows have been broken. The tin roof looks sturdy. Frankie walks around it once, and that's enough. He carefully steps through the weeds and returns to his truck. He's been sniffing around Dillon for 2 days and thinks he's found a decent suspect. Riley Taft's day job is chief custodian at the Dillon Middle School, but his real vocation is ministering to his congregation. He's the pastor of the Red Banks Baptist Church, a few miles farther out in the country. Most Tafts are buried there, some with simple headstones, some without. His flock numbers fewer than 100 and cannot afford a full-time pastor, thus the custodial job. After some phone calls, he agrees to meet Frankie at the church late in the afternoon. Riley is young, late 30s, thick-set, and easygoing with a wide smile. He walks Frankie through the cemetery and shows him the Taft section. His father, the oldest child, is buried between Kenny and his mother. He narrates the family tragedies, his grandfather dead at 58 from some mysterious poisoning, Kenny murdered, his father killed instantly on a highway,
His aunt dead from leukemia at 36. Vida Taft died 12 years ago at 77.
Poor woman went crazy, Riley says with wet eyes. Buried her three children and went off the deep end. Really off.
Your grandmother.
Yep. So why you want to know about the family?
Frankie has already gone through the song and dance about Guardian, our mission, our successes, and our representation of Quincy Miller. He says,
we think Kenny's murder didn't go down the way the sheriff said.
This gets no reaction. Riley nods to the back of the small church and says,
let's get something to drink.
They walk past the tombstones and markers of other Tafts and leave the cemetery. Through a rear door, they step into the church's narrow fellowship hall. Riley opens a fridge in a corner and pulls out two small plastic bottles of lemonade.
Thanks, Frankie says,
and they settle into folding chairs.
So what's this new theory? Riley asks.
You never heard of one?
No, never. When Kenny got killed, it was the end of the world. I was about 15 or 16, 10th grade, I think. And Kenny was more of a big brother than an uncle. I worshipped him. He was the family's pride. Real smart, going places, we thought. He was proud to be a cop, but he wanted to move on up. God, how I love Kenny. We all did. Everybody did. Had a pretty wife, Sybil, a sweet lady, and a baby. Everything going his way, and then he's murdered. When I heard the news, I fell to the floor and bawled like a baby. I wanted to die, too. Just put me in the grave with him. It was just awful.
His eyes water, and he takes a long swallow.
But we always believed he stumbled across some drug dealers and got shot. Now, 20-plus years later, you here to tell me something different, right?
Yes. We believe Kenny was ambushed by men working for Sheriff Fitzner, who was counting his money with the drug dealers. Kenny knew too much, and Fitzner got suspicious.
It takes a second or two for this to sink in, but Riley absorbs it well. It's a shock, really, but he wants to hear more.
What's this got to do with Quincy Miller?
He asks.
Fitzner was behind the murder of Keith Russo, the lawyer. Russo made some money as a drug lawyer, got flipped by the DEA and became an informant. Fitzner found out about it, arranged the murder, and did a near-flawless job of pinning it on Quincy Miller. Kenny knew something about the murder, and it cost him his life.
Riley smiles and shakes his head and says,
this is pretty wild.
You've never heard this gossip?
Never. You got to understand, Mr. Tatum, that Seabrook is only 15 miles from here, but it might as well be 100. Dillon is its own world. A sad little place, really. Folk here just barely hang on, barely get by. We got our own challenges, and we don't have time to worry about what's happening over in Seabrook, or anywhere else for that matter.
I understand that, Frankie says, and takes a sip.
So you did 14 years for somebody else's murder?
Riley asked in disbelief.
Yes, 14 years, 3 months, 11 days. And Reverend Post came to the rescue. It's brutal, Riley, locked up and forgotten when you know you're innocent. That's why we're working so hard for Quincy and our other clients. As you know, brother, lots of our people are locked up for stuff they didn't do.
You got that right.
They drink in solidarity. Frankie presses on.
There might be a chance, probably a slight one, that Kenny had possession of some evidence that was stored behind Fitzner's office in Seabrook. His former partner told us this recently. Kenny got wind of a plan to burn the building and destroy the evidence, and he removed some stuff before the fire. If Fitzner indeed ambushed Kenny, then why did he want him dead? It was because Kenny knew something. Kenny had the evidence. There was no other reason, or at least none that we've come across that explains Fitzner's motive.
Riley is enjoying the story. He says,
so the big question is,
What did Kenny do with the evidence? That's why you're here, right?
You got it. It's doubtful Kenny would take it home, because that could have endangered his family. Plus, he was living in a rental house.
And his wife wasn't too happy there. It was out on Secretary Road, east of Seabrook. Sybil wanted to move to some other place.
By the way, we found Sybil in Ocala, and she will not talk to us. Not a word.
A nice lady. Always had a smile for me anyway. I haven't seen Sybil in years. Don't suppose I ever will. So, Mr. Tatum.
Please, Frankie.
So, Frankie, you thinking Kenny might have brought the stuff back to the home place just down the road and hid it there, right?
The list of possible hiding places is short, Riley. If Kenny had something to hide, something valuable, he would have wanted to keep it somewhere safe and accessible. Makes sense, right? Does the old house have an attic or a basement?
Riley shakes his head.
There's no basement. I'm not sure, but I think there's an attic. Never seen it. Never been up there.
He takes a sip and says,
"This seemed like a real goose chase to me, Frankie."
Frankie laughs and says, "Oh, we specialize in goose chases. We waste tons of time digging through haystacks, but occasionally we find something."
Riley finishes his lemonade, slowly gets to his feet, and begins pacing around the room as if suddenly burdened. He stops and looks down at Frankie and says,
"You can't go into that house. It's too dangerous."
"It's been abandoned for years."
"By real people. But there are plenty of folk moving around. Spirits, ghosts. The place is haunted, Frankie. I've seen it for myself. I'm a poor man with a few bucks in the bank, but I wouldn't walk into that house at high noon with a gun in my hand for $1,000 cash. Nobody in our family will either."
Riley's eyes are wide with fear, and his finger shakes as he points it at Frankie, who is momentarily dumbstruck. Riley walks to the fridge, pulls out two more bottles, hands one to Frankie, and sits down. He breathes deeply as he closes his eyes, as if gathering strength for a long-winded tale. Finally, he begins,
"Vida, my grandmother, was raised by her grandmother in a Negro settlement 10 miles from here. It's gone now. Vida was born in 1925. Her grandmother was born back in the 1870s, when a lot of folks still had kin who were born in slavery. Her grandmother practiced witchcraft and African voodoo, which was common back then. Her religion was a mix of Christian gospel and old-world spiritualism. She was a midwife and the local nurse who could whip up salves and ointments and herbal teas to cure just about anything. Vida was profoundly influenced by this woman, and throughout her life, she too considered herself to be a spiritual master, though she knew better than to use the word witch. Are you with me, Frankie?"
He was. But they were wasting time now. Frankie nodded earnestly and said,
"Sure. Fascinating."
"I'm giving you the quick version. But there's a big, thick book about Vida. She was a frightening woman. She loved her kids and grandkids and ruled the family, but she had a dark, mysterious side, too. I'll give you one story. Her daughter Ramona, my aunt, died at 36. You saw her tombstone. When Ramona was young, about 14 or so, she was raped by a boy from Dillon, a bad kid. Everybody knew him. The family was upset, as you might guess, but didn't want to go to the sheriff. Vida didn't trust the white man's justice. She said she would handle things herself. Kenny found her one night at midnight under a full moon in the backyard going through some voodoo ritual. She was tapping a small drum with gourds around her neck and snake skins around her bare feet and chanting in an unknown tongue. Later, she told Kenny that she put a hex on the boy who raped Ramona. Word got out, and everybody, well, at least all the black folk in Dillon knew the boy was cursed. A few months later, he got burned alive in a car wreck. And from then on, people ran from Vida. She was much feared."
Frankie absorbs this without a word.
"Over the years, she got crazier, and we finally had no choice. We hired a lawyer in Seabrook to get her committed. She was furious with the family and threatened us. Threatened the lawyer and the judge. We were terrified. They couldn't do anything with her at the asylum, and she talked her way out. She told us to stay away from her and the house, and we did.
Frankie manages to say, she died in 1998, according to the obituary.
That was the year, but no one knows the day. My cousin Wendell got concerned and went to the house, found her lying peacefully in the middle of her bed, sheets pulled up to her chin, dead for days. She left a note with instructions to bury her next to her children, with no funeral or ceremony. She also wrote that her last act on this earth was to put a curse on the house. Sad to say, but we were relieved when she died. We buried her in a hurry, in a thunderstorm, a quick service with just the family, and the moment we lowered her into the ground, lightning hit a tree in a cemetery, and we jumped out of our skin. I've never been so scared in my life and never so happy to see a casket get covered with dirt.
Riley takes a long drink and wipes his mouth with the back of a hand.
That was my grandmother Vita. We called her Granny, but most of the kids around here called her Voodoo behind her back.
In a voice as firm as possible, Frankie says, we need to see the attic.
You crazy, man.
Who's got the key?
I do, but I haven't stepped inside in years. The electricity was cut off long ago, but you can sometimes see lights at night. Lights moving around. Only a fool would walk through those doors.
I need some air. They step outside into the heat and walk to their vehicles. Riley says,
you know, this is weird. Kenny's been dead for 20 years and nobody from the outside has shown any interest. Now, in less than a week, you and two others come snooping round.
Two others?
Two white dudes showed up last week asking questions about Kenny. Where did he grow up? Where did he live? Where is he buried? I didn't like them, and I played dumb, gave them nothing.
Where were they from?
I didn't ask. I got the impression they wouldn't tell me anyway.
Chapter 38. Quincy's first surgery is a 6-hour repair job, piecing together a shoulder and collarbone. It goes well, and the doctors are pleased. I sit with him for hours as he recovers. His battered body is mending well, and some of his memory is returning, though the attack is still a black hole. I do not tell him what we know about Drummick and Robert Earl Lane or Adam Stone and Skip DeLuca. He's heavily medicated and is not ready for the rest of the story. There is a guard of some variety sitting by his door around the clock, often more than one. Hospital security, prison guards, Orlando police, and FBI. They take turns, and I enjoy chatting them up. It breaks the monotony. I often marvel at the cost of it all. $50,000 a year to keep him in prison for 23 years now. A drop in the bucket to what the taxpayers are now spending to keep him alive and fix up his wounds. Not to mention the security. Millions, and all wasted on an innocent man who should never have been incarcerated in the first place. I'm napping on the rollaway cot in his room early one morning when my phone buzzes. Agent Knowlton asks if I'm in town. She has something to show me. I drive to her office and follow her to a large conference room where a tech guy is waiting. He dims the lights, and still standing, we look at a large screen. A face appears. Hispanic male, age about 60, ruggedly handsome with fierce dark eyes and a salt-and-pepper beard. Agnes says,
name is Ramon Vasquez, longtime senior management in the Saltillo cartel. Sort of semi-retired now.
The name is familiar, I say.
Hang on.
She clicks and another image appears, an aerial of a small resort tucked into the side of a mountain that is surrounded by the bluest water in the world.
This is where he spends most of his time. The island is Martinique, French West Indies. The getaway is called Oriole Bay Resort, owned by one of a million faceless companies domiciled in Panama. She splits the screen, and the face of Mickey Mercado appears. 3 days ago, our friend here used a Honduran passport to fly to Martinique, where he met with Vasquez at the resort. We showed up, but couldn't get in, and that was probably a good thing. The next day, Mercado used a Bolivian passport to return to Miami through San Juan.
It hits hard. Vasquez was the boyfriend of Diana Russo, I say.
Still is. They've been together since about the time of her husband's untimely death.
She clicks again. Mercado disappears, and half of the screen is black. The other half is still the island.
No pictures of Diana. According to what we've been able to piece together, and I won't bore you with stories of how shaky intelligence can be anywhere in the Caribbean, they spend most of their time living in luxurious seclusion at their resort. She sort of runs the place, but keeps an extremely low profile. They also travel a lot, all over the world. DEA is not sure if their travels are related to trafficking or if they just want to get off the island. They think Vasquez is past his prime, but still does a little consulting. Could be that the Russo murder happened on his watch and he's expected to clean up the mess. Or it could be that he is still active in the business. Whatever he does, he's extremely careful.
I back to a chair, fall into it, and mumble. So she was involved.
Well, we don't know for sure, but she suddenly looks a lot guiltier. She renounced her American citizenship 15 years ago and became a full-fledged citizen of Panama. Probably cost her 50 grand. New name is Diana Sanchez, but I'll bet she has others. Who knows how many passports? No record that she and Ramon have ever officially tied the knot. Apparently, they have not reproduced. Seen enough?
Is there more?
Oh, yes.
The FBI was monitoring Mercado and was preparing to arrest him when he made an inexplicable blunder. He picked up the wrong phone and made a call to a number that cannot be traced. The conversation, though, was recorded. Mercado suggested to the man on the other end that they meet at a crab shack in Key Largo for lunch the following day. Moving with a speed that is remarkable and makes me happy to be on the same side as the FBI, Knowlton got a warrant and her agents arrived first. They photographed Mercado in the parking lot, filmed him eating crabs with his contact, and photographed both as they got into their cars. The late model Volvo SUV is registered to Bradley Fitzner. On film, he looks to be in decent shape, with a gray goatee and waves of gray hair. Retiring in luxury seems to be suiting him well. He's almost 80 years old, but moves like a much younger man. Knowlton says,
"Congratulations, Post. We finally have the link."
I am too stunned to speak. She says,
"Of course we can't indict Fitzner for having lunch, but we'll get warrants and we'll know when he takes a pee."
I say, "Be careful. He's pretty savvy."
"Yes, but even the smartest criminals do dumb things. Meeting with Mercado is a gift."
"No clue that Fitzner has any contact with DeLuca?" I ask.
"None whatsoever. I'll bet my paycheck that Fitzner does not even know DeLuca's name. Mercado moves in the dark world where he knew about the Aryans and arranged the hit. Fitzner probably supplied the cash, but we'll never prove it unless Mercado sings. And guys like him do not rat."
I'm overwhelmed and struggle to keep things in order. My first reaction is, "What a train wreck." In the span of 3 days, Mercado leads you to Ramon and Diana Russo, and then to Bradley Fitzner. Agnes nods along, quite proud of their progress, but too businesslike to gloat.
"Some of the puzzle is coming together, but there's a long way to go. Gotta run. I'll keep you posted."
She's off to another meeting, and the tech guy leaves me alone in the room. For a long time, I sit in the dim light and stare at the wall and try to process these bombshells. Agnes is right in that we suddenly know a lot more about the conspiracy to murder Keith, but how much can be proven? And how much can help Quincy? I finally leave the room in the building and drive back to the hospital, where I find Marvis sitting with his brother. He tells me he talked his boss into a few days of vacation, and he'll be around. This is welcome news, and I hurry back to the motel and gather my things. I'm inching out of town in traffic when inspiration hits so hard I'm almost compelled to pull over and walk around my car. I keep driving as a simple yet beautiful plan takes shape. Then I call my new best friend, Special Agent Agnes Knowlton. "What's up?" she says crisply after I hold for 10 minutes. "The only way to nail Fitzner is to suck him into the conspiracy," I say. "Sounds like entrapment. Close, but it might just work." "I'm listening." "Have you already packed off DeLuca to parts unknown?" "No, he's still around." "We need one more job before he vanishes." At Hialeah Park, DeLuca takes a seat in the grandstand, far away from other spectators. He holds a racing sheet as if ready to start betting on the horses. He's wired with the latest bug, which can pick up a deer snorting 30 yards away. Mercado appears 20 minutes later and sits next to him. They buy 2 beers from a vendor and watch the next race. Finally, DeLuca says,
"I have a plan. They move Miller again, between surgeries. He continues to improve, but he ain't leaving for some time. The guards are rotating, and there's always somebody watching his door. The prison sends a few boys over now and then. That's where the plan begins. We borrow a guard's uniform from Stone, and one of my boys puts it on. He eases in late at night. On cue, there's a bomb threat at the hospital. Maybe we'll blow up something in the basement. Nobody gets hurt. Typically, the hospital will go berserk, active shooter drill and all that craziness. In the melee, our boy gets to Miller. We'll use an EpiPen needle, get one from the pharmacy, and load it with something like ricin or cyanide. Jab him in the leg and he's gone in 5 minutes. If he's awake, he won't be able to react in time. But they keep him knocked out a lot. We'll do it late at night, when more than likely he'll be asleep. Our man walks out and disappears into the confusion."
Mercado sips his beer and frowns.
"I don't know. Sounds awfully risky."
"It is, but it's a risk I'm willing to take. For a fee."
"I thought there were cameras everywhere."
"Above the door, but not in the room. Our guy gets in because he's a guard. Once inside, he'll do the deed in seconds and then join the chaos. If he gets his picture taken, no big deal. No one in hell will ever know who he is. I'll have him on a plane within an hour."
"But Miller's in a hospital surrounded by good doctors."
"True, but by the time they identify the toxin, he'll be dead. Trust me on this. I poisoned 3 men in prison and did it with homemade juice."
"I don't know. I'll have to think about it."
"It's no sweat for you, Mickey, except for the cash. If our boy screws up and gets caught, he won't talk. I promise. If Miller survives, you keep the other half. But prison hits are cheap. This ain't prison."
"How much?"
$100,000. Half now, half after his funeral. Plus the other $25,000 from the first hit."
"That's pretty steep."
"It'll take 4 men, me and 3 others, including the bomb maker. It's far more complicated than shanking some stiff in prison."
"That's a lot of money."
"You want him dead or not?"
"He's supposed to be dead already, but your thug screwed up, dead or not. It's too much money.
It's chump change for you boys."
"I think about it."
Across the track and next to the paddocks, a crew in the back of a delivery van films every moment as the bug captures every word.
Fitzner takes long walks with his second wife, fishes with a buddy in a sleek 32-foot Grady White, and plays golf every Monday and Wednesday in the same foursome. From all indications, dress, home, cars, nice restaurants, clubs, he is quite affluent. They watch him, but they do not go into his house. Too many security cameras. He has an iPhone that he uses for normal conversations, and he has at least one burner for the more sensitive calls. For 11 days, he ventures no farther than the golf course or the marina. On the 12th day, he leaves Marathon, driving north along Highway 1. By the time he reaches Key Colony Beach, the plan is activated. It is ramped up when Mercado leaves Coral Gables headed his way. He arrives in Key Largo first and parks in the lot outside Snook's Bayside Restaurant. Two agents in shorts and floral print shirts ease in and take a table near the water, 30 feet from Mercado's table. 10 minutes later, Fitzner arrives in his Volvo and goes inside without his gym bag, one of several mistakes. As Mercado and Fitzner dine on seafood salads, the bag is removed from the Volvo. Inside are five stacks of $100 bills wrapped tightly with rubber bands. Not fresh new banknotes, but bills that have been stashed for some time. A total of $50,000. Two stacks are removed and replaced with newer bills whose serial numbers have been recorded. The gym bag is returned to the rear floorboard of the Volvo. Two more agents arrive, rounding out the team of 10. When lunch is over, Fitzner pays the bill with an American Express card. He and Mercado exit and step into the sun. They hesitate by the Volvo as Fitzner unlocks the door, opens it, grabs the gym bag, and without unzipping it and looking inside, hands it to Mercado, who takes it so nonchalantly it's clear he's done it before. Before Mercado can take one step, a loud voice yells, "Freeze! FBI!" Bradley Fitzner faints and falls hard into the car next to his Volvo. He crumples to the asphalt as the agents swarm Mercado, take the bag, and slap on cuffs. When Bradley stands, he's dazed, and there is a cut above his left ear. An agent wipes it roughly with a paper towel as the two suspects are loaded up for the ride to Miami. Chapter 39. The following day, Agent Knowlton calls with the news that Skip DeLuca is on a plane headed to Mars with a new identity and the chance for a new life. His girlfriend plans to join him later. Agnes passes along the latest with Fitzner and Mercado, but nothing has changed. Not surprisingly, Nash Cooley's law firm is representing both, so the prosecution will soon grind to a halt while the lawyers gum up the system. Both defendants are trying to get out on bond, but the federal magistrate won't budge. Her voice is more relaxed, and she ends the conversation with, "Why haven't you asked me to dinner?" Any pause would show weakness, so I immediately say, "How about dinner?" In my usual state of cluelessness around the opposite sex, I had not bothered to notice if she wears a wedding band. I would guess her age at 42. I seem to remember photos of children in her office. "You're on," she says. "Where shall we meet?" "It's your city," I say on my heels. "The only food I've eaten in Orlando has been in the basement cafeteria of Mercy Hospital. It's dreadful, but cheap." I desperately try to remember the balance on my last credit card statement. "Can I afford to take her to a nice restaurant?" "Where are you staying?" she asks. "At the hospital. It doesn't matter. I have a car." I'm staying in a cheap motel in a sketchy part of town, a place I would never mention. And my car? It's really a little Ford SUV with ball tires and a million miles on the odometer. It hits me that Agnes knows this. I'm sure the FBI has checked me out. One look at my wheels, and she'll prefer to meet at the restaurant rather than go through the formality of me picking her up. I like the way she thinks.
There's a place called Christner's on Lee Road. Let's meet there. And Dutch Treat.
I like her even more. I may even fall in love with her. If you insist. With a law degree and 18 years of seniority, her salary is around $120,000, or more than mine, Vicky's, and Maisie's combined. In fact, Vicky and I really don't consider ourselves on salary. We each extract $2,000 a month to survive and give ourselves a bonus at Christmas if there's anything left in the bank. I'm sure Agnes realizes that I live in poverty. I dress in my only clean shirt and well-used khakis. She breezes in from the office and, as always, is well put together. We have a glass of wine at the bar, then retire to our table. After we order another glass of wine, she says,
"No shop talk. Let's talk about your divorce."
I chuckle at her abruptness, though I've come to expect it. "How'd you know?"
"Just guessing. You go first and talk about yours, then I'll talk about mine. And in doing so, we'll avoid talking about work."
"Well," I say, "it was a long time ago," and I launch into my past. Law school, courting Brooke, marriage, the career as a public defender, my nervous breakdown that led to seminary and a new career, the calling to help the innocent. The waiter hovers, and we order salads and pasta dishes. She's had two divorces, actually, a minor one that followed a terrible first marriage, and a major one that was settled less than 2 years ago. He was a corporate executive who was transferred a lot. She wanted her career and got tired of moving. It was a painful split because they loved each other. Their two teenagers are still trying to cope. Agnes is intrigued by my work, and I'm happy to talk about our exonerees and our current cases. We eat and drink and talk and enjoy a delightful meal. I'm thrilled to be in the presence of an attractive and intelligent woman, and also to be dining outside the hospital cafeteria. She seems to crave conversation that is unrelated to her work. But over tiramisu and coffee, we drift back to pressing matters. We are baffled by the actions of Bradley Fitzner. For many years now, he has lived a comfortable life far away from the scene of his crimes. He never came within a mile of being indicted. He was suspected and investigated, but too smart and lucky to get caught. He walked away with his money and laundered it nicely. His hands are clean. He did a fine job of putting Quincy away and making sure Kenny Taft would never squeal. Why would he now run the risk of entangling himself in a plot to kill our efforts by killing Quincy? Agnes speculates he was acting on behalf of the cartel. Perhaps, but why would the cartel, and Fitzner too for that matter, care if we walk Quincy out of prison? We are no closer to identifying the hired gun who murdered Russo 23 years ago. And if by some miracle we learn his name, it will take three more miracles to link him to the cartel. Exonerating Quincy does not equate to solving that murder. Agnes speculates that Fitzner and the cartel assumed the hit in prison would be easy and leave no clues. Just find a couple of tough guys pulling hard time and promise a little cash. Once Quincy was buried, we would close the file and go away. We agree that Fitzner, in his old age, probably got spooked when he realized someone with credibility was digging into a matter he considered stone cold. He knows our case has merit, and he knows from our reputation that we are tenacious and usually successful. Walking Quincy out of prison would leave many unanswered questions. Hauling him out in a hearse would bury those questions. There is also the real possibility that Fitzner believed himself to be immune from any reckoning. For years, he was the law. He operated above it, below it, within and without, did whatever he pleased while keeping the voters content. He retired with a fortune and considers himself quite clever. If one more crime was needed, and one as straightforward as a prison hit, then he could certainly pull it off and never worry again. Agnes entertains me with tales of incredible blunders by otherwise smart criminals. She says she could fill a book with such stories. We speculate and second-guess and talk about our pasts late into the evening, thoroughly enjoying the long conversation. The other diners clear out, though we hardly notice. When the waiter gives us the look, we realize the restaurant is empty. We split the check, shake hands at the door, and agree to do it again. Chapter 40. When the FBI sank its fangs into Adam Stone and Skip DeLuca, I realized that Quincy Miller has one beautiful civil lawsuit. With the active complicity of a state employee, Stone, the assault became an intentional tort far more actionable than the garden variety prison beating. The state of Florida became liable and has no way out. I discussed this at length with Susan Ashley Gross, our co-counsel, and she recommended, hands down, a trial lawyer named Bill Cannon of Fort Lauderdale. There is no shortage of tort stars in Florida. The state's laws are plaintiff-friendly. Its juries are educated and historically generous. Most of its judges, at least those in the urban areas, lean toward the victims. These factors have spawned an aggressive and successful trial bar. Just observe the billboards along any busy Florida highway, and you'll almost wish you could get injured. Switch on early morning television, and you're bombarded with hawkers who feel your pain. Bill Cannon doesn't advertise because he doesn't need to. His stellar reputation is national. He spent the past 25 years in courtrooms and convinced juries to fork over $1 billion in verdicts. The ambulance chasers who roam the streets bring him their cases. He sifts through their nets and selects the best ones. I decide to hire him for other reasons. First, he believes in the cause and donates generously to Susan Ashley's Innocence Group. Second, he believes in pro bono and expects his partners and associates to donate 10% of their time representing the less fortunate. Though he now zips around in his own jet, he grew up poor and remembers the pain of getting stepped on when his family was wrongfully evicted. 3 days after Mercado and Fitzner are arrested, Cannon files on behalf of Quincy a $50 million federal lawsuit against the Florida Department of Corrections, Mickey Mercado, and Bradley Fitzner. The lawsuit also names Robert Earl Lane and John Drummock, the assailants, along with Adam Stone and Skip DeLuca, but they will be dismissed later. Immediately after filing the lawsuit, Cannon convinces a magistrate to freeze the bank accounts and all other assets of Mercado and Fitzner before the money slips away and disappears into the Caribbean. With search warrants, the FBI assaults Mercado's fancy condo in Coral Gables. They find some handguns, temporary phones, a cash box with only $5,000, and a laptop with little valuable information. Mercado lived in fear and avoided leaving tracks. However, two bank statements lead the FBI to three accounts totaling about $400,000. A similar raid on his office nets little more. Agnes assumes Mercado kept his goodies offshore in shady banks. Fitzner wasn't quite so oily. A raid on his home was temporarily slowed when his wife went nuts and tried to block the doors. She was finally subdued with handcuffs and threatened with jail. Bank records lead to three accounts in Miami, where the good old boy sheriff has almost $3 million in cash. A money market account has slightly over $1 million. Not bad for a small town sheriff. Agnes thinks there's more. Ditto for Cannon. If Fitzner was brazen enough to keep $4 million in dirty dollars in U.S. banks, imagine what he stashed offshore. And Cannon knows how to find it. While the FBI starts leaning on Caribbean banks, Cannon hires a forensic accounting firm that specializes in tracking dirty money funneled out of the country. As confident as he is, Cannon does not make predictions. He is, however, confident that his new client will recover a substantial amount in damages, minus, of course, the obligatory 40% off the top that stays with the law firm. I am silently hopeful that Guardian might get a few bucks to pay its utility bills, but that rarely happens. Quincy, though, is not thinking about money these days. He's too busy trying to walk. The doctors have operated on a shoulder, both collarbones, a jaw, and he has thick plaster on the top half of his torso and around one wrist. They have implanted 3 new teeth and braced his nose. He is in constant pain, but tries gamely not to mention it. He has tubes draining one lung and one side of his brain. He is so medicated, it is difficult to determine how well his brain is working. But he is determined to get out of bed and move around. He growls at his physical therapists when their sessions end. He wants more, more walking, bending, massages, rubdowns, more challenges. He's tired of the hospital, but has no place to go. Garvin has nothing to offer as rehab, and the health care is far below subpar. When he's wide awake, he quarrels with me about getting him exonerated so he doesn't have to return to Garvin. Chapter 41. Word has spread through the family, and some of the Tafts are not happy with the idea of anyone poking around into Vita's haunted house. The feeling is that she hexed it before she died and filled it with angry spirits who can't get out. Unlocking the doors now could release all kinds of evil, with most of it undoubtedly aimed at her descendants. She died holding a hard grudge against those who sent her to the asylum. She was crazy as a coot in her final days, but that didn't stop her from blanketing the family with curses. According to Frankie, one strain of African witchcraft believes that curses die with the witch, but another says they can last forever. No living Taft wants to find out. Frankie and I are riding in his shiny pickup toward Dillon. He's driving, I'm texting. On the console between us is a 9mm Glock, properly purchased and registered by him. If we gain entry into the house, he plans to take it with him. You don't really believe in all that witchcraft stuff, do you, Frankie? I ask. I don't know. Wait till you see the house. You won't be so eager to go inside. So you're worried about ghosts and goblins, stuff like that. Keep laughing, boss. He touches the Glock with his right hand. You'll wish you had one of these. You can't shoot a ghost, can you? Never had to. But just in case. Well, you go in first with the gun, and I'll follow, okay? We'll see. If we get that far. We pass through the sad little town of Dillon and wind our way deeper into the country. At the end of a gravel drive, there is an old pickup parked in front of the dilapidated house. As we slow to a stop, Frankie says, There it is. The guy on the right is Riley, my buddy. Don't know, but I guess the other guy is his cousin Wendell. He could be the troublemaker. Wendell is about 40, a working man in dirty boots and jeans. He does not smile during the introductions and handshaking. Nor does Riley. It is immediately obvious that a lot has been said, and these two have issues. After a minute's worth of small talk, Riley asks me, So what's your plan here? What do you want? We would like to go into the house and look around, I say. I'm sure you know why we're here.
Look, Mr. Post, Wendell begins respectfully. I know that house inside and out. I lived here off and on as a kid. I found Vita when she died. and not long after she was gone, I tried to live here with my wife and kids. Couldn't do it. The place is haunted. Vita said she put a hex on it, and believe me, she did. Now you looking for some boxes, and I'm telling you, you're not likely to find anything. I think there's a small attic, but I never saw it. We were too afraid to go up there.
Then let's have a look, I say, as confidently as possible. You guys stay here while Frankie and I poke around. Riley and Wendell exchange hard looks. Riley says,
"It ain't that easy, Mr. Post. Nobody wants those doors open."
"Nobody? As in?" I ask.
"As in the family," Wendell says with an edge. "We got some cousins round here, others scattered, and no one wants his place disturbed. You never knew Vita. But I'm telling you, she's still around, and she's not to be trifled with."
There is trepidation in his voice. "I respect that," I say, "but I only sound sincere." A breeze that only a second ago did not exist rustles through a willow tree with limbs overhanging the house. As if on cue, something grinds and squeaks on the backside of the roof, and my arms instantly are covered with goosebumps. All four of us gawk at the house and take deep breaths. We need to keep talking. I say, "Look, fellas, this is nothing more than the old needle in the haystack. No one knows for sure if Kenny Taft really took some evidence before the fire. If he did, then no one has a clue what he did with the stuff. It could be here in the attic, but chances are it disappeared somewhere else years ago. This is probably a waste of time. But we chase every lead. We just want to look around and then we'll leave. Promise."
"What if you find something?" Wendell asks.
"We'll call the sheriff and turn it in. Maybe it can help us. But regardless, it's nothing that has any value to the family. With these poor folks, the idea of some family jewels hidden in the attic is ludicrous." Wendell takes a step back, walks around as if deep in thought, leans on the fender of a car, spits, crosses his arms against his chest, and says,
"I don't think so."
Riley says,
"Right now, Wendell's got more support than I do. If he says no, then the answer is no."
I spread my hands and say, "1 hour. Just give us 1 hour and you'll never see us again." Wendell shakes his head. Riley watches him, says to Frankie,
"Sorry."
I give both of them a look of disgust. This is probably a shakedown, so let's get it over with. I say,
"All right.
Look, this property is assessed by Ruiz County at $33,000. That's roughly $100 each day for the entire year. We, Guardian Ministries, will lease the house and these premises for one day for $200, from 9 tomorrow morning until 5 tomorrow afternoon, with an option to extend one extra day at the same rate. What do you say?" The Tafts absorb this and scratch their chins.
"Sounds low," Wendell says. "How about $500 a day?" Riley asks. "I think we could live with that."
"Come on, Riley. We're a nonprofit with no money. We can't just pull cash out of our pockets. $300.
$400, take it or leave it."
"Okay." Agreed. Under Florida law, any agreement dealing with land must be in writing. I'll get a one-page lease contract, and let's meet back here at 9 in the morning. Deal? Riley seems pleased. Wendell barely nods his head, yes. We leave Dillon as fast as possible and share a few laughs along the way. Frankie drops me off near my car on Main Street in Seabrook and heads east. He's staying in a motel somewhere between here and Gainesville, but as always, the details are vague. I enter the law offices of Glenn Colo.